From the National Endowment for the Arts, this is Artworks. I'm Josephine Reed.
The reason I chose to write something similar to my life is I just feel like I have not seen much like this in Western literature about a queer Muslim girl from Queens, you know? I mean, everything about her class background, you know, her queerness and her identity also as a budding artist, because really that's what she is. You know, this is a portrait of an artist as a young woman as well. And so all of those aspects, I really wanted to see a book like this in the world. And so that's why I wrote it and I chose this content.
That's writer Bushra Rehman talking about her novel, Roses in the Mouth of a Lion, a book the New York Times calls stunningly beautiful and one that I think is simply terrific, though there's nothing simple at all about it. Roses in the Mouth of a Lion is a coming-of-age story, loosely based on Bushra's own girlhood, growing up in a tightly knit Pakistani-American community in Corona, Queens. Her character Razia is a natural scholar, growing up in a religious household, and who, though closely supervised by her parents, still manages to wander the neighborhood, engaging in minor rebellions with her closest friend Taslima. Things change for Razia when she's accepted into the highly selective Stuyvesant High School in Manhattan, which broadens her world and slowly opens her up to her own queer identity. Bushra Rehman is an award-winning poet and teacher and well-known as an outstanding spoken word artist. Her previous books include the novel Corona and the poetry collection Mariana's Beauty Salon. She's also co-editor with Daisy Hernandez of the groundbreaking anthology Colonize This, Young Women of Color on Today's Feminism. Bushra brings a poet's descriptive language and an editor's specificity to Roses in the Mouth of a Lion. The novel revolves around family, religion, friendship, and the neighborhood of Corona, Queens, which can be seen as a character in and of itself. In fact, Bushra Rehman begins Roses in the Mouth of a Lion by introducing us to the Corona, Queens of the 1980s.
Corona. I'm talking about a little village perched under the number 7 train in Queens, between Junction Boulevard and 111th Street. I'm talking about the Lemon Ice King, Spaghetti Park, and PS19. The Corona F. Scott Fitzgerald called the Valley of Ashes, as the Great Gatsby drove past it on his night of carousal, what me and my own know as home. And we didn't know about any Valley of Ashes, because by then it had been topped off by our houses. You know, the kind made from brick, this tan color no self-respecting brick would be at all. That's Corona. And you know the song by Paul Simon, the one where he says, I'm on my way, I don't know where I'm going. I'm on my way, I'm taking my time, and I don't know where. Goodbye to Rosie, Queen of Corona. See you, me, and Julio down by the schoolyard. Well, at first I couldn't believe it was Corona he was singing about, because why would Paul Simon be singing about Corona? I didn't see many white people there, unless they were policemen or firemen, and I didn't think Paul Simon had ever been one of those. Then I saw these pictures of him standing in front of one of those tan brick homes. What I thought was a lie was true.
That is wonderful. That is the beginning of Roses in the Mouth of a Lion, and we are in Corona. The specificity is so important to that story. What did you want us to know about that neighborhood of Corona at that time?
Well, so I'm a deep New Yorker, deep New York City kid, and I used to teach poetry to public school children in all the boroughs. And one of the exercises we always did was to celebrate our neighborhoods. And one day I was writing with them, with the kids, and I started writing about my home neighborhood of Corona. And I realized there's so much power in finding the beauty of where we come from, and especially when where we come from is a place that is often misunderstood. Is, you know, it's an under-resourced neighborhood. People are afraid to go there, you know. But when you're from that neighborhood, you know, there's so much just life and family and love and community that I really wanted to celebrate in this novel. And specifically my Pakistani Muslim community that I really wanted to celebrate. And, you know, as we know in this country, there is a lot of Islamophobia. And I think that what happens is that the Islamophobia makes our communities become more insular, more private, and then it just becomes a loop where then people know less about us. And so this book is really meant to crack that open, you know, to kind of open the door, to bring our stories into public awareness.
Razia has such strong and complicated relationships with both her mother and her father. Mm-hmm. Her father isn't a big presence in the book, but he comes through so clearly, as does Razia's love for him.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, he's, you know, like many of the fathers, working multiple jobs, you know, working night jobs, day jobs, like trying at some point to start a business because he thinks it's one way that he could then, you know, continue to be amongst his family and in the neighborhood and, you know, run his own business. But because he's so generous, because he's so giving, because he doesn't really ever want to take money from anyone, he just wants to feed everyone for free, you know, the business fails. And he's a very important figure. And I think it was, again, important for me to show a figure of a Muslim man in literature who's gentle and loving and kind.
Well, he certainly is all that. And her mother is formidable. Mm. Formidable. Describe their relationship.
Well, so the mom, you know, the mom is really tough. And I find that I often see this happens is that the father can get to be the gentle parent, right? And the mother has to be the tough parent because the kids have to be strong. I mean, they are growing up in a place where they have to be safe. You know, they don't have a lot of money, so they have to learn to fend for themselves. They have to be strong, and the mother has to be strong. And I think she passes this on to her children. And, you know, she passes on her religious training to Razia. And Razia is very spiritual. I mean, you know, I am paying, you know, homage to books that I loved growing up, like A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. And so it's very much Razia's relationship to Allah is like, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. You know, she sees Allah as her ally, you know, as someone who she can talk to as her therapist or as her best friend. And but she's getting all her religious training, you know, from her mother. And her mother grew up in a way where she never learned how to read. And so she, despite what some of the, you know, quote unquote religious scholars might say in the community, she is like, my daughter is going to go to school. My daughter is going to learn how to read. And although it causes her fear when her daughter leaves the neighborhood to go to, you know, Stuyvesant High School, you know, she still, you know, knows that her daughter has a different life path than her, as difficult as that is for her to accept.
She's also a force within the community.
Yes.
She teaches the Quran to other girls in the community, and she steps in when somebody's being abused.
Yeah.
I mean, she's quite a force.
Yes. The thing about teaching Quran is often that is something that women could do to make money. And when her Razia's grandmother was widowed, that's how she supported the family. It was teaching Quran. And this is how her mother also helps to support the family. And she's very charismatic, very powerful, very charming. And right, she's fierce. She's a fierce woman. You know, when I think about my own persona as a feminist, you know, I think that I get my ideas of what power and what women's power is from people like Razia's mother, who there are many women I knew like this growing up.
And as you said, religion is so central, and Razia's faith is really important to her. Mm-hmm. And so we see how that becomes complicated as she's desiring to question some of the rigidity in the way her family practices mm-hmm. her faith.
Yeah, you know, Razia, like many queer children, has always felt different, you know, and because it's the 80s, and because in the 80s, as we know, queer culture was not mainstream culture, you know, even some of our biggest figures like George Michael, who plays a role in the book, you know, there's all these undercover queer figures who are put into the book as well. You know, she doesn't understand why she feels different. She doesn't understand why she doesn't want to get married and other people do. And so when she meets a young woman who she's attracted to and who is also attracted to her, she can actually, you know, act on her feelings, but she knows that she has to keep them secret from her family and community. And she's even afraid to tell some of her best friends in the community too. And, you know, I think this is something that isn't just something that happens in Muslim communities. I identify as queer. I have friends from all backgrounds. And it's been a struggle for many of us, especially people my age who grew up in the 70s and 80s. And we hope that because of the kind of cultural activism that we've all been involved in for decades, that, you know, life can be easier for younger queer people now. And I think as I've been putting this book out, you know, I've been learning more about Islam and queerness, and I have so much to learn, but there's so many scholars and activists who are, sharing how, you know, queerness has always been a part of our culture. You know, we've always been here. You know, that's the thing. It gets erased over and over again, but we've always existed, you know.
Her friendships are so key. Mm-hmm. And when you're a teenager, when you're young, how important these friendships are to you, your friendships with other women, if you're a girl, especially, they're just everything. And she has a great partner in crime in Taslima.
Yes, yes. I mean, I think that friendship, and I often say this, is friendship is proof that there is a benevolent force at work in the universe. Because, you know, what is friendship? Just such a beautiful thing between people. You know, it's not about money. It's not about prestige. It's just about caring for someone who's not your blood. You know, you choose, they're your chosen family. And, you know, the way I grew up, very similar to Razia, and I grew up in a Pakistani community in Queens. And at that time, you know, people's families were still in Pakistan. And so your aunties and uncles were your parents' friends. And it was wonderful because there was so little drama and so much love, you know. And I think that because of that, these girls are also learning that friendship is everything. And friendship is how you survive, how you build community. You know, literally, people would help each other, raise their kids, lend each other money. If someone didn't have a place to live, they moved into your house. It was really about survival, friendship and survival, but then also joy, you know, and laughter and humor also as a survival technique.
And I just want to give a big shout out to Eliza, who's Taslima's older sister, who's making her own decisions about her life, yet is deeply respectful to her parents and is really trying to set these two girls, Razia and Taslima, straight.
Yeah. Yes. You know, what I wanted to do in this book was really reflect that it's, you know, no culture is homogenous, but every single friend of Razia's is different. You know, Eliza wants to just get out of the neighborhood, you know, wants to go away to college and never come back, is reading feminist texts. The Slima and Razia are younger and they're not really thinking exactly along those terms. They just want to have fun. You know, the Slima just is really into fashion, you know, so she just wants to like make her own clothes and wear them out in public and hope she gets noticed, you know. Razia is like a bookworm, you know, so they're all very different from each other, but they're thrown together because their parents are friends. So they are friends as well.
Well, as we said, Razia gets into Stuyvesant High School, which is a highly selective public school in Manhattan. And that really accelerates some of the changes we are beginning to see. How does she begin to change when she gets into Stuyvesant?
Well, first, I think it's this way that she's always felt different. It's now been noticed. It's been officially noticed that she is different in this way, that she goes to the school, she leaves the neighborhood, and she suddenly is in the East Village. At the time, Stuyvesant, it's no longer in the East Village of Manhattan, but it was in the East Village. And this was the East Village of the 80s and the 90s, like, you know, Lou Reed style East Village, where, you know, it's very gritty, it's very punk rock. And so Razia is there, and suddenly she's seeing all kinds of different people. I mean, obviously in Queens, she's seeing lots of different people, but she's not seen what she sees in the East Village of art everywhere. And she's seeing artists and even same-sex couples. So her world starts to expand. And although she doesn't thrive in the classroom there the way that she thrived in her classrooms in Corona, she stops going to school and then just uses that time to basically explore Manhattan. And it was really fun to just write about all these places in Manhattan that I also love, you know, like she goes to the Met instead of going to the school, you know, she goes to Central Park, she rides back and forth on the Staten Island Ferry, you know, she just falls in love with New York City. And I think she just has freedom of movement, you know, which I think is something that city kids have earlier on sometimes because of the subways and the buses. There is this way that she can just go all over the place, you know, without her parents knowing.
I'm nodding vigorously because I grew up in New York.
Oh, yes.
And I always maintain that. We had so much more freedom.
Yeah, I know. You don't have to have someone driving you everywhere.
Nobody has to drive you. You get on a bus or you walk or you... Taking the subway on your own, that was a definite step that came later.
Yes.
But buses, walking, go.
Mm-hmm.
She begins this passionate friendship with Angela, mm-hmm. who becomes her lover. Mm-hmm. And Angela also opens her eyes in more ways than one, more ways mm-hmm. than her sexuality, though God knows that's big, because she grew up in the East Village.
Yes. And Razia is very impressed by that. She grew up in the East Village, and Angela's mother and her are both readers. And so their house is just filled with books, you know. So to Razia, who loves libraries, she's like, oh my God, this house is like a library. And so she starts to almost imagine, like, well, what if I could have an apartment one day that's filled with books? What if I could have an apartment in a city where I could be anonymous, you know, because in Corona, everyone knows her, whether it's the bodega owner, all the uncles or the aunties, like all the kids from her school. But here she realized she can be anonymous in the city, and she's craving that anonymity so that she can, you know, start fresh and create her own self. And so she starts to feel these things with Angela, and takes her to the Strand, and she goes to the West Village for the first time and sees that out queer community. And so that is a way that Angela opens up her world. And, you know, Angela also, her parents have just gotten divorced. And so Angela is also lost and struggling. So I think that there's a way that they're both kind of lost. Not lost, that's maybe not the right word, but they're both feeling...
They're searching.
Yeah, searching, that's the word.
Well, Razia isn't only the protagonist, she's also the narrator.
Yes.
Why the decision to make it a first-person narrative?
You know, I did play around with both. And then I just felt that ultimately it felt more authentic, and it felt more like a diary, you know, just something that I wanted people to just be as close as possible to this narrator. And I felt that any kind of barriers I could take away between the reader and Razia, the reader and the narrator, I wanted those barriers to be removed. And so I decided to go with first person. But it took me a while to figure out what the exact perch was, because for example, that opening paragraph is told from like an older Razia, you know, who's now describing the neighborhood. But I had to know for myself what age she was when she's giving that description, you know, and it's soon after the book ends, but not too soon, not too long after the book ends. And it took me a while to find out exactly like what that perch was for the narrator to speak from.
I was going to ask you how long it took you to find her voice, because it's a voice that ages, so changes over time. It's not like an adult narrator whose voice can be pretty stable. I mean, she's in the midst of flux.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it took me a long time to write this book, and sometimes I would leave it for long periods of time. And then in order to find that voice again, I would write a lot of poetry. I have another book called Corona, in which there are some parts of this book in that book. And so that book came from a bunch of poetry I was writing about Corona. And so this voice really came through poems that I was writing about Corona, about the city, about being, you know, Pakistani American in the city. And so the voice comes very much from that spoken word world of New York City in the 90s. Then as it continued to grow, I think that I just brought in a lot of the humor that I experienced in my chosen family, and the characters, as the characters started to come alive, like Eliza, you mentioned, and Taslima, they really took off. And sometimes I had to remind myself to give Razia some dialogue, because, you know, Eliza and Taslima could just talk and talk and talk. And I was like, okay, Razia has to have some dialogue as well.
Well, the book is a novel, mm-hmm. obviously, but I have to think it has echoes of your own life. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how you navigated that, and especially navigated that with your family.
The reason I chose to write something similar to my life is I just feel like I have not seen much like this in Western literature about a queer Muslim girl from Queens, you know? I mean, everything about her class background, you know, her queerness, and her identity also as a budding artist, because really, that's what she is. You know, this is a portrait of an artist as a young woman as well. And so all of those aspects, I really wanted to see a book like this in the world. And so that's why I wrote it, and I chose this content, these concepts. And I teach a class called Two Truths and a Lie, Writing Memoir and Autobiographical Fiction. I think about what it was I would take a little tiny seed of something that happened to me or to someone else, and I would just allow it to grow into a scene, you know, I would just mix it up. And I think the best metaphor, which is my favorite bird is the mockingbird. You know, I think that this book is very much like a mockingbird song where I just listen to all these different things and then I put them all together into a narrative. And the thing with my family, I mean, my father passed away a few months before the book came out, and it's been very hard. But I think that strangely, you know, I think his opinion was the one I was maybe most concerned about. And I do feel that now in this ancestral world that he is in, I feel pride, maybe. Who knows if it's in my mind. you know, for everyone else, I can honestly say it doesn't matter. I mean, I've obviously, you know, my mom called in the middle of this. You know, we have, and this is what I teach to my students too, is that families go through all kinds of things together. And they get mad at each other, and then they make up, and then they get mad at each other, and they make up. And one should never deny themselves being an artist because of their fears of what their families are going to say, because you have to live your own life path. And, you know, you have your own soul, you have your own purpose in life. And if you're driven to be an artist, like, that is your purpose. And that is what you have to fulfill. And your family will hopefully ultimately accept you. And if they do not, then, I mean, I'm a queer person, so I have a chosen family. You know, you build chosen family, you know, you build other families. I am close to my family. And I was working on this book while my dad was dying and in hospice. And I think that a lot of what I wanted to put in this book was honoring what people like him have made in this country, you know, and many of the other aunts and uncles are also no longer with us who are in this book. And because COVID hit Queens very, very hard. And so, you know, I think about it and it's like, this is a time capsule of these beautiful people. And I want their memories to live on.
Well, you've examined aspects of growing up and moving on in your earlier book, Corona, which you refer to. And that's mm-hmm. a series of linked vignettes that mm-hmm. move around in time. And actually is great to read with Roses. Mm-hmm. I read Roses first and then Corona. Oh. but I wonder what compelled you to return to this territory, what you did in Roses that you didn't do in Corona.
Well, what's interesting is, Corona came first. So basically, when I wrote Corona, I was much younger. And Corona jumps around in time between Razia's childhood and then her adventures on the road and even older, you know, in her 30s. And I knew that all throughout that, I was avoiding writing about, you know, one of the hardest things for many queer children, which is when, if they are outed and they don't want to be, or if their parents find out and it's kind of hard. I was avoiding that moment, you know. So much of the experimental structure of Corona, which jumps back and forth in time, is almost like a magician's trick. So people will not notice that actually the most important part of the book is not in there, which is when she is disowned from her family, you know. And so in this book, I wanted to just go into that absence, into that erasure, into the hardest thing, you know, until my father passed, one of the hardest things that had happened. And so that part is very autobiographical. And so once I went into that, which I thought was going to be this black hole, it turned out that there was just all this, like all these friendships I remembered and the community. And also I rediscovered aspects of my own self as a spiritual person when I was writing Roses, because I remembered like, oh, I used to really enjoy that. Or, oh, wow, I remember, you know, speaking to Allah that way. And again, it is not memoir, but I gave Razia a lot of those experiences. Because again, I almost feel that spirituality is a human right. And when a queer person is cut off from their religion or spirituality, something very, very important is being taken away from them. And for me, I feel that in writing this book, and Roses took about 10 years to write, in writing this book, I rediscovered those aspects of my own spiritual core.
You come to writing through poetry, mm-hmm. and you've done a lot of spoken word poetry. You've had a collection of your poems published. So this is kind of a two-parter, but I'm wondering when you first started to write and if you knew early on that writing would be a driving force in your life, or is that something you came to later?
I always wrote in my diary, and you know, we didn't have money to buy a diary, so I would just like staple together loose leaf, and that was my diary. My diary was a place that I could basically pour out everything that was happening in my life that I couldn't share with other people. And I started writing poetry early on too. There was one year when I didn't go to school for a year. It's a long story, but I didn't go to school for a year. And so I just entertained myself and kept my mind agile through writing poetry. And I write poetry about everything. I would write stories. And so I kept myself busy that way. I never thought it could be a career because, again, you know, I wasn't seeing anyone who looked like me or wrote about the things I wrote about in the books that I was reading. And so I never thought it could be a career. And then when I moved back to New York City in my 20s, someone turned me on to this group called the South Asian Women's Creative Collective. And I started going to meetings, and it was people like me. They were South Asian women. Now many identify as a South Asian non-binary artists. And we would all meet once a month and share our work with each other. And then we would put on shows and fundraisers. And then I discovered other communities like this. I mean, this was in the late 90s in New York City. And there was all this like arts and activism happening with BIPOC artists. And then, you know, I discovered Kaveh Khanum and Kundiman and the South Asian Lesbian and Gay Association. And it was just a very exciting time, but none of that translated into a workable living. So I was also working at bookstores. I worked at the Strand for a while. I started teaching in the public schools, you know, through amazing organizations such as Teachers and Writers Collaborative, which were created by, you know, June Jordan and Kenneth Koch and other poets who felt that New York City public school children weren't getting the arts education that everyone has a right to have. And so that was an amazing job. I love that job. I would just teach poetry to children. And so, yeah, I was teaching poetry to children in the daytime and then performing poetry in the night. And it was an amazing time. But I love fiction. I love, you know, prose. And so ultimately, I knew I did want to write a novel, but I had to learn how to write a novel.
You know, we often think of writing as a solitary process, and it often is, but it isn't done in isolation. That creative family is so necessary, I think.
Oh, yes. I mean, for me, it is so much about the community. And I know that I would not have this life if it was not for those fellow artists in the South Asian Women's Creative Collective, you know, in Kaveh Khanum, in Kundiman, in all these organizations that have been like family. And I run these writing circles as well, in which I'm, you know, a mentor and a teacher to young writers. And I'm now the big sister and the auntie in these families, you know, and I think that, you know, we have 2-hour classes and then we go hang out for 3 hours, you know, because I feel like it's in the hanging out that the beauty of the artist's life also happens.
You and Daisy Hernandez are the co-editors of Colonize This, mm-hmm. which celebrated its 20th anniversary a couple of years ago. I mean, that is insane.
Yes.
Can you explain a bit about that book for listeners who might not know about it?
Well, thanks for bringing it up and thank you so much for this deep dive. It's fun. So Daisy and I met through these communities, you know, I was doing open mics and Daisy heard me at an open mic, and we were both in this other organization called Women in Literature and Letters, which was founded by these Latinx writers, Angie Cruz, Martha Lucia, Adelina Anthony. They started this organization, and we would have free writing workshops because the founders had gone through MFA programs and had a really hard time. And so they wanted to create these safe spaces for, again, I'm using language from the time, that women of color to gather in each other's living rooms and teach each other writing. So I met Daisy that way. And Angie actually recommended that Daisy and I work together on this book. And it was an amazing experience. Daisy is still one of my closest friends. And we were both had learned about feminism in college. And we felt, again, that the women like my, you know, my mother, like a woman like Razia's mother, a woman like Daisy's mother, like a lot of time these mothers and aunties were not portrayed in the feminism, like we felt that there was a feminism we were learning at home of how to be fierce, and there was a feminism we were learning in school. And we wanted feminism to be a philosophy that would be for everyone. We wanted feminism to be a philosophy that women in our communities also would benefit from. And so what we did was and this is like before social media and even really before internet really took on. So it was very word of mouth. We just put a word out that we wanted to collect stories from women of color who identified as womanists or feminists or who were even struggling with those concepts. And we wanted to read essays by them. And We got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of essays, and we ended up choosing 28 for the first anthology. And we didn't just choose them. We ended up working with each writer over multiple drafts, like over a period of a year or more, and really having some amazing conversations and hard conversations about their essays. And then in 2019, we actually did a new edition because we felt that so much had changed. You know, we wanted to bring in, you know, Black Lives Matter, trans justice, the amazing work that undocumented students were doing in the city schools in New York City. You know, we wanted to bring in all this activism that was taking place in the last 20 years. And we felt that it was time to put out a new anthology. So in 2019, we did one with new essays, new forewords. And so many people have gone on to tell me, you know, what this book has meant to them, because this book contains the experience of, you know, Black, Indigenous, Latinx, Asian, South Asian, Muslim, so many different experiences and so many ways of viewing feminism and womanism. And it's something that Daisy and I are really, really happy that we did. And it's been one of the things in my life that I am very proud of.
As we said, you began as a poet, mm-hmm. and that's really clear from the way you use language, which is so wonderful and powerful. But I wonder if it was challenging to transition to fiction and what you had to consider that you didn't have to consider when you were writing poetry.
Oh my God, there's so much. And I think one day I would love to teach a class on this or something, because there's a lot of poets who want to transition to fiction writing. One thing is that, you know, poetry is like a sprint. I could sit down, I could get an idea, I could just sit down and write a poem. And even if it's not finished, the essence of it is there. You know, with fiction, it's a long marathon in which you have to sustain that level of energy and excitement for each scene. A lot of these stories and chapters did begin as a poem. I had one image in mind, one object in mind, one moment in mind that I wanted to write about. And so I would start as a poem, and then I'd have to develop the characters, and then I'd have to make sure the characters were consistent with how they appeared in other chapters. I had to add dialogue that, again, felt authentic to who the characters were. You know, I was working with multiple languages, and often many of the characters are not speaking English, but I'm translating what they're saying into English. And when I was doing those translations, I'd have to make sure that the translations, even if they weren't word for word, that the rhythm of the sentences was more similar to the rhythm of the sentences of the original language. So in that way, poetry came in really handy. So many of these chapters start out as a visual moment, the way that a poem would start out as a visual moment, but much harder to write prose.
One thing I really appreciated is you don't over-explain cultural references. Mm. You just trust the reader will figure it out, mm-hmm. or can find Google and do it. And it makes me happy because you're not taken out of the book.
Yes, thank you. I mean, that really was important for me. One of my cardinal rules was that I did not want to explain the references, because often for me as a person from this background, if I was reading a book from another South Asian writer and they started to explain the reference, then I would think, oh, this book is not for me. You know, I want everyone to love this book and enjoy it. But I was really thinking of a young, queer, a working class Pakistani girl who might find this book in the library, and it's for her, for them. So I feel that that does take readers out of the moment, and I wanted readers to stay present in the moment. And I think my poetic background of just giving lots and lots and lots of description is a way around that. So like there's one scene where they're like making samosas, and you know, I really had to like go into all the details of it, but make it part of the narrative, you know. But you could actually learn how to make samosas like by reading that chapter.
Well, speaking of a young queer Pakistani girl, mm-hmm. we leave Razia in a liminal moment. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean to imply it's a cliffhanger. It is not. But she's about to move into the world. And I'm hoping we're going to be able to read about her doing this.
I hope so, too.
Are we?
Yes, yes. I am. You know, the thing is that these characters are not done yet. You know, I had a little time to write yesterday, and I was writing, and it's just like the scenes are coming. I mean, I'm really excited because I'm going away on a writing residency, and I just want to spend time thinking about what this next book is going to be, but those stories are definitely being downloaded right now.
Well, Bushra, I do look forward to seeing what happens to Razia next. It's been such a great journey to take with her. And I'm signed up for the rest of the ride whenever that bus pulls up.
Thank you. Well, hopefully it will be much sooner since I don't have a young child. And, you know, so I think that it will be a lot faster of a process, hopefully. Thank you for this conversation.
Not at all. Thank you. That was Bushra Rehman. We were talking about her novel, Roses in the Mouth of a Lion. You can keep up with her at bushrareman.com. You've been listening to Artworks, produced at the National Endowment for the Arts. Please follow us wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a rating on Apple. It will help other people who love the arts to find us. And let us know what you think about Artworks. Email us at artworkspod@arts.gov. For the National Endowment for the Arts, I'm Josephine Reed. Thanks for listening.